Hello, and welcome to our series, Career Resilience, where we talk with people about their career path and their career journey, and maybe we can all learn from each other. My name is Jan Daniluk, and I'm a human resources professional in London, Ontario, Canada. I work with Ford Keast LLP, and I work with my clients to help them with the HR side of their business. We hope that you will enjoy these discussions with real people about real challenges and real working life situations. Welcome. My guest today is Rick Crawford. Welcome, Rick. So good to see you.
Oh, great to see you too, Jan. Good evening.
Thanks for joining me. We have quite a list of topics to talk about tonight, including your role as a firefighter and your role as an entrepreneur and owning your own business. But a big focus of our discussion is going to be about your daughter, Thea, and the things that you as a, and your family have gone through with Thea. So that is our plan. Thanks for being open to chat with me about all those things. So let us start with work. Let's start with your role as a firefighter. What is your thought about career resilience when it comes to being a firefighter?
Well, that's definitely changed over the years. When I first started, we didn't live in such a politically correct world. And it was a very, very tough time. And I had a tough go when I first started. I didn't play hockey. I didn't play rugby. I didn't play football. I was a cross-country runner and a basketball player, and these were not acceptable things in their little niche of the world. So as soon as you started there, they found every little nick and cranny they could find. It was basically literally the old boys club. There was no women. There was one minority. it was a much different world. You had to have a very, very thick skin. That's for certain.
Really? Like if you had been a hockey player, that would have been different?
Would have changed the entire script.
Because?
You played hockey. So you understood the world. Because you had a history of playing hockey, and they felt you understood the world of what it took to be a brother and to be a firefighter and to share that type of work experience as a team when you're in life-threatening situations on a semi-regular basis. Yeah, it was an interesting, and it took a long time to win people over. It was a tough go. It was I almost gave it up a couple times. And when I first started, I got hired by East York, which most people probably won't even know what that is. And we got amalgamated by Toronto 2.5-3 years in.
Yeah.
And I left East York as soon as I could, because East York had 3 halls and no opportunity, no experience, nothing to do except that little pocket of people. And I left quickly and got myself a different type of position, a different role in a much larger area of the city. And that's when things turned for me. I'm like, all right, found my place, found my groove, and, you know, more confidence, a little more age. You know, I got on when I was 26, so pretty young to be thrust into that role.
Isn't it really tough to become a firefighter?
So they tell me. Yeah, it certainly was when I started. I applied at a number of places. And you started to realize you're on a bit of a tour. You'd see the same faces in these arenas full of people, 3,000 people writing this test for 40 spots or 50 spots. So you saw the same people over and over again. Eventually, I got hired by East York. It took 2.5-3 years, I guess. And I obviously was working elsewhere to make a living. And then when the call came, I'm like, yeah, I think I'll take that challenge. It was sort of in my blood. I grew up at the fire hall, the volunteer hall.
Yeah.
That's where I grew up.
Okay. So what is your favorite aspect then of being a firefighter?
Well, that happened about, years go by, 4 or 5 years ago. I got promoted and I became an acting captain. And funny enough, my old business partner, I've known him almost as long as I've been in a fire department. He's always called me captain. And I think that's sort of my personality. Maybe why I didn't get along with guys at first when I was 26. Maybe it was too much of a captain too early. But as soon as I became an acting captain, I really gravitated to that role. And I have loved it ever since. I really, really enjoy it. And I'll be a full captain probably in a couple months. I'm coming up for full promotion. And I'm excited about it. I really like the job. And I really like the interaction I have with the other crew now. And I really love going to work now. There was a bunch of years where I didn't like it. Now it's every day. So I used to like, oh, I can't wait to retire. Now I'm like, oh, it's only 4 years away. It's coming fast. But I love
congratulations on those moves, Rick. Congratulations.
Yeah, I love it. It's fun. And I got myself transferred to my local fire hall. So as I will tomorrow morning, and it's my turn to go in, I walk to work and I walk home. And when I run calls, I'm in my own community. I see people I know. I help people I know. And the kids, my kids walk up with a dog and they say hi. And I really love my work environment now.
So can you tell us an example of a harrowing experience you've had as a firefighter?
Harrowing. We've certainly seen a lot of stuff that would make a lot of people's stomachs go. A long time ago, we were first in. We had a working fire. We knew it was a working fire as soon as we left the hall. You could see the smoke, and you could tell by the calls coming in it was working. We pull out onto Laird Avenue in Toronto, and it's an old Quonset hut type of building, like a garage. So, and like 30, 40 years old. So it's full of the walls and the rafters are coated with oils and gases and stuff, and it's wood. So it's rolling. And we get up there, and it's pumping out through the front door. And they felt one of the young workers was still inside in the back. And we made entry into it as a crew. It was extremely hot already. We got probably 30, 40 feet into it, and it's rolling over our heads. The flames are overhead. The lights are popping. Tires are exploding. Things are going off. We're crawling on our hands and knees. We get in there really deep, and all of a sudden, the hose goes dead. We got no water, nothing. And then all of a sudden, the whole thing rolled over top. It's called a rollover, flashover. We had our hoods on, we're down flat on the ground, and it rolled right over top of us. Melted our helmets, singed the back of our coats. It was very, 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 very hot. So luckily, my crew out in the street was able to figure out what was going on, why we lost pressure. And that happens a lot in Toronto, old hydrants, old sewer systems, rocks stuck in there. And luckily got us water back quick, and we were able to get the water going again. So obviously reduces the heat, and we were okay. And we get to a thing, we find out the young lad had skipped out the back door before we even got on scene.
That's very funny. So Rick, when you say working fire, that means it's a fire that means business?
Yeah. That's go time.
Okay.
That's go time.
Yeah.
That's serious business, because it's especially nowadays with the combustibles and the heat of fire, it's much different than it was, 40 years ago when everything was made out of wood and wool and stuff like that. Now it's all plastics, and it burns fast and hot and quick. And it's much different. Fighting fire is a lot different nowadays than it was years ago.
Yeah. Okay. You know what? There'd be so many questions to ask you about that, but I think we're going to move on to talking about your other life as a business owner. So what made you decide to also become a business owner? Wasn't firefighting enough for you?
Oh, well, that's a good question. So when I first started on the fire department, I was already working another full-time job, making three times what I made when I became a firefighter. So I went from making a lot of money as a young 26-year-old to making not much at all. So I remember sitting around the table at the fire hall and going, what am I going to do? I had this girlfriend at the time who was came from a family of money, and there was expectations. And I'm like, oh no, I can't afford. We got trips planned, and I'm in trouble here. This is not good. So I'm like, what can I do that requires very little skill set, very little overhead, and loss of opportunity? And I can, utilize my skills that I've learned through being a firefighter and what I've done in the past. Mm-hmm. And it was window cleaning. So I got, at the time, I had a roommate, and I mentioned it to him. He's like, oh, I ran a window cleaning company when I was at university. I'm like, well, that's great. He says, well, here's a list of things to buy. I'll teach you how to clean the windows on the front porch of our house. So I did that. And he says, get some flyers, print it up. Which was a big deal back then. You didn't just go on the internet. It didn't exist. And I got my Honda Civic. I had a Honda Civic, and I had all these ladders strapped on top of it. And I literally went door to door. And I built a big, huge client list, and I did that for 10 years. So it was really about money, because I knew in my mind that firefighting wasn't going to provide me and my family what I wanted to accomplish in life. And it was not about greed. I'm not a greedy person. It's never been about that. It's about doing things. And you live in Toronto, things cost money. And firefighting, and I never complain, and have never once complained about what the city pays me and how we're compensated. I think it's all fair. No qualms with that. But I realized I wanted more. So I was single at the time. And firefighting, the way our shifts work, gives you lots of time off. And I had lots of time off, and I was young and fit. I'm going to make more money. So that's when I started the window cleaning business.
And then you decided to get into junk removal. What's the name of your company?
1-800-RID-OF-IT.
Okay. And I looked, and it says the slogan is, "We clear the way so you don't have to."
Well, that's right. I forgot that.
You have your own slogan, Rick?
No, I don't. But I have certain skill sets in life. And that's one thing I recognize. I'm not creative. I'm not, I don't think in that mindset. I'm a doer. I'm an operations person. So creativity and all that type of stuff, that's not my forte. I paid that, part of that came with the company, and I paid for the rest of it. They do all that stuff. And I'm like, okay, sounds great.
It's a great slogan. Yeah.
Thank you.
So have your team found anything fabulous in the junk?
Well, luckily, you know, we've been successful over the years. So I don't work in the trucks as much as I used to, thankfully. And I'm a little older now, so it's nice not to be in the trucks. But over the years, there's certainly lots of stuff. I remember once, about 3 or 4 years, Matt, current guy, him and another guy were cleaning an apartment. And the fellow said, "Oh, my brother passed away. I don't want anything in this place. It's all bad memories. It's all whatever. Are you sure you don't want anything? We find." Yep. So there was several area rugs, thank you. And they were rolling the area rugs up to throw into the truck. And as they rolled each area rug up, they realized there was money taped to the bottom of the mats, all of them. And it had been there for, they have no long idea how long it had been there. It had been there, it was a hoarder. So the place was covered it was full to the rafters. So the client was nice enough to say, "You know what? Don't want it. You keep it." And he let the guys keep all the money. So that was an interesting thing. The guys found it. And a nice story about a nice person as well. So
Yeah. Hoarders, that's a whole other thing.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to switch over to talking about you as a dad and the experiences that you've had with your daughter, Thea. And my understanding is that at 15 years old, she was diagnosed with stage 4 Hodgkin's lymphoma.
That's correct.
Can you take me a little bit through the story of how you found out that that was the case?
That was horrible. So for a couple months before that, and to put it in context, at the same time, you know, she's a full-time high school student. She was racing downhill, ski racing, and pretty good at it. You know, we're not going to the Olympics or anything, but she's a very good athlete. She was swimming competitively and doing gymnastics and very active, right? And she'd been lazing around a bunch. And we thought, oh, she's just being 15 and get out of bed and get going and all that stuff. And then she started having some trouble breathing. And so we took her to the doctor twice, actually. And they, you know, they listened to her lungs and like, "Oh, you're okay." They didn't see anything. No, you're okay, okay. And then her lymph nodes got very, very large. So, wife called our doctor, and he lives a couple blocks over from us, actually. And it was COVID. So put your mind to all of this, right? So stock markets crashed. My business is, I'm also an investor. My stock business has crashed. The world's going crazy. So the doctor says, "You know what? I'll come over to the house. I'll check that out. And then we'll see. We'll go from there." So he comes over and he checks out there. And he says, "You know what? Bring her into the office on Tuesday." And that weekend, my daughter comes to me and she's very, very upset. And I'm like, what's going on, baby? And she's like, Daddy, I got cancer. She's, what do you mean? Come on. You know, and your first thing is like, yeah, whatever. Come on. Don't be like that. Silly talk. And she's like, no, Daddy. And at the time, she was taking cancer at school. So that would have been grade 10 biology. And I'm like, no, come on, baby. She's like, I do, Daddy, I do. And she broke down. And I'm like, no, it's okay. It's okay. So Kira, my wife, took her to the doctor Tuesday morning. And I was at work at the fire hall. And we're going to a call. And I could see my cell phone was sitting just on the middle section of the truck. And I see it ringing, and it's Kira. And I know right then. Like, I know. I knew. I knew it. 2 seconds. I told the story a million times. Every time, it's the start point that always gets me. Yeah. I knew our lives were changed forever right then when I saw the phone ringing. And they said, oh, 2 seconds. I need some water. 2 seconds.
Yep. I know these are tough questions, Rick.
It's always the start. Once I get into it, it's fine. It's the start that gets me. Because there is a little bit of hangover, guilt feeling about, you know, we should have caught it sooner and all that type of stuff. But it's all nonsense. Anyways, the phone rings and my wife's in tears, obviously. And she's like, I got to take Thea to sick kids now. Emergency. Doctor's like, get it right there. So they run down to sick kids. And this is where, oddly enough, and people think, oh, that's crazy, COVID worked in her favor. She gets to sick kids and it's empty. There's nobody there because it's shut down. So they go in eMERGE. There's like one other kid in eMERGE. They is immediately seen by like 20 people. And they take her upstairs and right away, they knew. Everybody knew right away. So there's no waiting for tests. It was like, oh, no, come back. It was done. We knew in like, I don't remember all the days. It's a blur.
Yeah.
In a day or two, like 2 days, I was at work. My son, Alexander, is home by himself. At the time, he was 12, 11. Man, things are a blur. And I'm at work, and I'm trying to function. And finally, my chief, he's like, go home. What are you doing here? Yeah. Like, 'cause he knew I was in like shock a little bit, right?
Of course,
like,
of course.
Go, like, get out of here. And then... tributes to Toronto Fire, the chief above him got hold of me the next couple days and said, listen, just go, do whatever. We'll see when we see. So, and then my crew at work's been great. They were so supportive. They're all family guys too, and they all got kids, and they were awesome. So, no, that's how it all started.
How long was she in sick kids?
Oh, it's very blurry, because even when she's not technically in sick kids, she's still going for tests all the time. So I think it was like, man, I want to say 6 to 8 weeks every day. So we knew we had to figure out a plan. And with COVID, because she was a minor, they allowed one parent to be with her. So I'm like, it's got to be you, Kira, because I gotta run my business. I gotta look after, like, I gotta keep everything else going, right? I have rental properties, investments, like, mm-hmm. She's got to come home to something, right? We just can't just throw our hands up in the air and say, oh, because she's sick, I'm giving up and we're done. No, you can't do that, right?
Yeah.
So you have got to be point. You've got to meet the doctors. You've got to be the one down there. I'm sorry, but it's the only way it's going to work, because we can't have a doctor see me one day and then you the next day, and then we try to relay it through each other. It's too much going to get lost. You're going to have to take point. So Kira was down there every day. When she'd let me, I would go down. She didn't want to leave her baby's side. So I would go down and see her normally at night, sometimes at day, but normally at night. So Kira would come home and shower and spend some time with Alexander and, you know, get something proper to eat and lay in her own bed for a couple hours type of thing. And then we'd switch it back up. It went on like that. It felt like for eternity. But
So, Rick, you're a firefighter. You're an action-oriented person. You're a get-her-done kind of person. How did that feel when there was nothing you could do?
Oh, I know where that question's going. It was gut-wrenching, honestly, Jan. It was horrible. Like, I'd never felt so literally helpless in my entire life.
Yeah.
And it was horrible. Like, my son and I had a lot of tears. We spent a lot of time together and talking. And then I would try to call Thea, but she was always sleepy or on drugs or whatever, right? So it was really tough because you're on your own, right? And what I did do was I avoided the internet in terms of researching or looking about what her disease was and the odds and all that stuff. I avoided that stuff like crazy because I knew once you go down that rabbit hole, you're never getting out.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, I'll stay focused, listen to the doctors, and sick kids is renowned, and it's true, they're the best. You take your best hospital experience you've ever had, times it by 100, now you got sick kids. Like, they're pros all around.
Yeah.
And that's, I just focused on that. Like, if anybody's going to save her, it's them.
Yeah. So when was the corner turned for her?
So after they don't tell you a lot in terms of until the chemo starts taking effect, that takes a while. So it took about 2 months, I want to say. Man, time is horrible. And then they started seeing reduction in the size of the tumors. And that's we knew we were making some progress, right? She was able to start breathing properly. So they started when the radiation was tough and her hair was falling out and all that stuff. And then she came home. She was coming home after that. Once they got her stabilized and stuff, she was coming home, which was good and bad. It was tough on her brother to see her like that. It was tough on everybody. And then COVID, good and bad. Because if she was immune compromised, she wouldn't be able to see a lot of people anyway. So people were coming by our house like constantly. And my brother set up what's called a food train. So people were dropping off food all the time. And then we got positive news that the tumors were reducing in size. So that was the stress reliever for all of us. Yeah. The unfortunate part was because it took because it was stage four. And stages don't mean so much for lymphomas because once it's in your lymphatic system, it's in your whole body. So it's not like we think about 1, 2, 3, 4. But because the growths were so large, they knew from the beginning she was going to have radiation. And that's the worst part. Chemo is hell for the time being. Radiation can cause you trouble long term. And even they had to build a special harness for her head so they could hang her in this chair thing, this bed, so the tumors would slide away from her heart or her lungs so they could radiate them without damaging her heart or lungs further. So
she wouldn't have been conscious for that, though, right?
I think she was. No, she wasn't. No, she wasn't. There were parts of it, yes, parts of it, no.
Yeah.
But we're talking about my resilience here. It's really... She's the one you got to talk about being resilient. She's the trooper. Yeah, she's tough.
How is she now?
She's great. And it's hard to ascertain mentally where she's at because, again, the stupid COVID, good and bad. She's suffering like all her other friends. So I think COVID, again, helped her out, really, because she's experiencing the isolation and the completely screwed up high school experience, all that stuff. Same as all her friends are, right?
Yeah.
So they're all in this battle together, but she's done well. I want to say, jeepers, December maybe, she got a job at the local Canadian Tire store, and she's logging now over 30 hours a week. 22, 24 hours a week already. Then that's a lot of walking. They have their little counters on their phones. And she's logging 10, 12, 14 kilometers a day on this day and tire store, stocking orders and walking about to cars. And she loves it. Everybody there, she loves it. So she's tough that way.
Now, I wanted to ask you, she did a video, and I'm going to link the video when I post our interview. But did a video, and I've watched it a few times because it's incredible. It's incredibly inspiring. Seeing her and her mom together. I love that part of the video because you can just tell that the amount of love between the two of them is just so amazing to see. where did she get the courage to be someone that could do a video like that?
I certainly don't know. My business partner, who I spoke to with today, who him and I were roommates actually 25 years ago. He said, you know, he said, buddy, when I found out Thea had cancer, he says it broke me, but he knew that if anybody would be strong enough, it would be her. So he says she got it from me, but I don't know about that. Yeah. I have a feeling my wife's pretty tough somewhere in there to put up with a firefighter and an entrepreneur and a bit of a tough ass for 20 years. So there's probably a lot of toughness going around.
Yeah. You know, your daughter has the most beautiful eyes. And in looking in that video and looking into her eyes, it was just like she draws you right in. Like it's pretty powerful. And I hope that people watching or listening will take a look at that video.
And that's a great organization that who did that. They help, and we didn't rely on it. Obviously, we're lucky we didn't need it, but they help families, that, especially those who come from out of town that have to stay in town and cost a lot of money for accommodation and travel and food. And this organization helps them with all the financial stuff. So.
Oh, that's great. That is so great to have those resources that help, because we need all the help we can get when we're in a trauma situation.
Yeah.
I did want to ask you about your son. He's 13. I guess he was 12 at the time. Yeah. How did he cope with all this? It's hard enough to be a kid at 12 and 13 or a boy at that age. How did he get through it all?
Definitely because of who he is, but also because I'm hoping I helped him through it. Like I said, I moved my office home.
Yeah.
My wife was point. I was here working at the house. He was home doing homeschooling. So it was really him and I every day, every night, right?
Yeah.
For a couple months. And him and I, luckily, we're still buddies. We still get along. We still talk. I know he was very confused and unsure and afraid and upset, like all the natural things to be.
Yeah.
Him and his sister, they get along pretty well. She's the big sister. She's always giving him a bit of a hard time. You know how all that goes. But, they're very tight. And I don't know the depth of their relationship, because that's their relationship and that's fine. But he and obviously, honestly, I got to say video games help for sure. Yeah. Because just like her and everybody else cut off from the world, he was able to connect with his buddies and through these, I can't remember what they call the video games, but they can all talk to each other and or see each other while they're playing stuff. So I know he found a lot of support in that. And through his sporting activities, he's a baseball player and a downhill skier. So the downhill skiing world, everybody in that world knows both of them, because they've both grown up with the same group of parents and kids and stuff. So there was support from there, because those people were always reaching out to him too. So
I asked you before about resilience in your job as a firefighter, but I'd like to ask you, what is resilience to you related to being a dad?
To being a dad, well, that's a good one. I don't know if it differs between work and being a dad or not. I don't know. To me, resilience is moving forward, pushing through the ups and the downs and the bads, and really keep it in the back of your mind that you'll figure this out. There's always brighter days ahead. And that's, you just got to keep pushing. And, you know, you have to reflect on the past and understand that, in my opinion, no expert, what's happened. But you can't dwell on it. You can't get yourself chained down. It's not ankle bracelets, right? You got to shake free and try to move forward as best you can, right? And whatever comes your way, you got to be able to prepare for the worst and keep rolling. And I think for parenting, it's the same thing.
It you know, is the same.
They write lots of books, but honestly, I have never read one book on parenting, because it's nothing to me. It doesn't apply. Your kids are different than everybody else's kids. You just got to keep moving forward with them and hopefully guide them in the right direction, that they'll find their path and keep moving forward, right?
What did your own dad teach you about being a dad?
Unfortunately, my father and I weren't overly tight. Our parents had us at a very young age, and I couldn't have fathomed having children at 25 or 24. I don't even want to think about what I was doing at that age of children. So I don't know. Unfortunately, my dad, like I said, we had a tough go. And him and I were not close. And that I've always found that upsetting to this day. And he's gone now. That also happened this year in the midst of my dad's sick, my daughter's sickness, and the whole world now crashing down, you know, business crashing, stock market, everything. My dad also passed away, as did his sister, within 6 weeks of each other in the same home. So very tough situation. Yeah. I was actually very close with my mother. And my mom had some difficult times dealing with the family situation in a rural community, not a lot of support network. So I think I learned a lot from my mother about being resilient, quite honestly. I really, if I was to say, you know, where did it come from in that situation, I'd say a lot of it came from my mom, which is a funny comment because if you were to meet my mom, it's not a descriptor most people would give her because she comes across as more of a sweet, genteel, chilled out type of person. But I think under the skin there, honestly, that's where the resilience probably came from in the most way, because she dealt with everything that wasn't getting dealt with. And she moved forward and kept my brother and I moving forward. So yeah. I'd say that's probably where it came from.
Yeah. I wanted to end, or close to end, by asking you what advice you would give your younger self.
Huh, interesting. That's a good one, actually. One thing I've always found now, especially I've gotten older, I was never goal-focused or goal-driven. And I find I never had an ultimate plan. I never had an end post. I never had, this is my next thing. I was running on something within inside of me. And at times, I think that's left me a little yearning or wanting or a little, what next? Like, what do I do now, right? And especially now that I'm getting older, I'm in my early 50s, it's like, what's next for me? Yeah. And I think along the way, I probably should have read more, which may seem like a funny thing, but I've always tried to circle myself with people who I think know more than me or smarter than me, more successful than me, all that type of stuff. And whether they are or not, it's irrelevant. It's what I think they are. Mm-hmm. And they've helped guide me along. And every single one of them I noticed, they read a lot. And I'd say at the end of the day, I should have read more. And I went to university and all that, but I never kept up reading a lot. And I think that's one thing I'm sort of starting to gravitate back towards now. I've had some friends of mine in that realm just give me some books randomly. It's like, oh, maybe they notice I need to read some more as well. I don't know. And I'm certainly now I'm happy about it. I'm having more time in my life to read more. And I've always read fiction. I've always been a fiction reader, tons of it. I guzzle books like that. But I mean nonfiction, not fiction. More nonfiction, the boring stuff that people like force themselves to read. I should have read more of that.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
Okay, and my final question is, what would be a piece of advice you would give to dads?
Let your kids be your kids. Don't put yourself into them too much. They are not you. They are other people. They're part of you, but they're not you. Let them find their way. Let them on their own. Give them the base, the support, but don't stand in their way. I find a lot of parents stand in their kids' way. Just let them fail, let them fall, let them get back up, help them up, but don't pull them up. You know what I mean? Let them struggle, let them fall. I think kids nowadays don't fall enough. They don't get hurt enough, you know, bruised and battered, and you know, whether it be, you know, literally or figuratively, both really. Much is done for them. Let them find their own stuff, let them falter, you know. It's like when I got her job at Canadian Tire, for instance, good example. Of course I helped her get her first job. That's what parents should help do. That was it. I walked to the store and I lined up in line because she asked to see the person. And I said, oh, Thea, I got to go look over in the hardware section. I'll talk to you in a minute. She looks at me with this appalled look. I'm like, and I walked away. And that was it. She got the job on her own, but I helped her. I didn't get the job for her, you know? And I think kids need to figure out how to do stuff on their own.
Yeah. Thanks, Rick. Thanks for chatting with me today.
No problem. My pleasure. A little emotional there for a bit. It wells up sometimes. It's been quite a year.
It's so understandable. So
yeah.
To our listeners and viewers, thank you so much for joining Rick and me today. We heard a story of resilience and bravery, and what an incredible family the Crawford family is. So I just really appreciate the kind of candid conversation that we had. Please do join us on my YouTube channel, subscribe, follow me on my podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, and please be sure and take a look at my website, career-resilience.com, which is also where I house my blog. So thanks, and until we meet again.